You're listening to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta. Welcome to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm your host, Amanda Plum. Each week, we talk to interesting folks from around Atlanta about the cool things that they're doing. And my guest today is singer-songwriter and puppeteer David Stevens. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to have you.
No, this is fun.
It's been a while since I've seen you.
I know. And it's appropriate because I live on North Avenue, so it's, yeah, I know. That's
this show is about people like yourself living on North Avenue and doing really cool stuff. So you're a puppeteer.
I am, yep.
And I want to talk about how that started. Like, when you were a kid, were you really into puppets?
I was into the Muppets. Like, I was a huge Muppet fan when I was a toddler. I remember watching reruns of the Muppet Show.
So that's like the late 70s or early 80s?
Yeah, I was born in 77, so the Muppets were in their second season, the Muppet Show on TV. So they were sort of reaching their apex of popularity. And yeah, I remember watching them all the time as a kid, from Sesame Street to the Muppet Show, because Fraggle Rock was on cable and we didn't get cable because I grew up out in the boonies in Alabama, so we didn't have cable. So occasionally I'd go visit my grandparents who did, by some fluke, have HBO. We'd get to see a couple of episodes of the Fraggles every now and then. So I sort of absorbed every bit of Muppetness I could get. But the Muppets, I don't know. I like the craziness of it. I like the real oddball characters that would show up every week.
Like who?
Like Crazy Harry or Lou Zealand or sort of these reoccurring, Lou Zealand is the boomerang fish thrower, or Marvin Suggs, who, hits the little guys on the head to make them sing. The guest stars were really superfluous for me. It didn't really matter who it was because that's not why I was watching. That's why, millions of other Americans were watching, but not me. I wanted to see what these crazy puppets were going to do.
Did you have any puppets as a kid?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, if my parents ever went out of town, that's how it goes usually. They bring you something back. Well, my parents, instead of a T-shirt or a knickknack or whatever, would bring me a puppet. And I would get, Muppet, the Fisher-Price Muppet puppets for Christmas or birthdays or that kind of thing. So, yeah, I had puppets as a kid. It wasn't so much the fact that they were puppets. It was just Muppets. I had this real fascination with the Muppet characters and that whole world. And it wasn't until, I was a little older that I really got into sort of, puppets. Okay, that's how they work, and that's what they are, and that's okay. I sort of put all that together.
So you think you just liked the brand, like the personalities of the characters?
I think it was like the color and the movement, and it was just this really bright, fast-paced, sort of kinetic thing. Because, most of the Muppets and the Fraggles, they have all this, like, moving feather hair that just is nonstop moving. So I think there was a lot of that really appealed to me. The goofy voices and that kind of thing.
And who was your favorite Muppet?
Dr. Teeth was definitely my favorite Muppet. He's just a very sort of colorful, loud, musical character who was really cool at the same time.
So when you had your own puppets, did you perform shows for your family?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I remember I had a record of the Country Bear Jamboree from Disney World, which is my favorite attraction. And the first side of the record is nothing but the audio from the show. And so I would set up my room to be like the Country Bear Jamboree, and I would make poor unsuspecting relatives sit through my rendition of sort of a puppet version of the Country Bear Jamboree.
Can you tell me about your very first puppet?
A next-door neighbor who was a seamstress, her name was Elsie Lipscomb, made one for me when I was about 7 years old that was a lion, and that's kind of was my first puppet. And she sort of made the base of it, and I put a face on. But the first sort of puppet that I created from nothing, well, it's actually not from nothing. It was from a house shoe. And we had a friend of the family who made these house slippers for us out of fun fur. So one day I was playing around with these things. We all had them, my dad, my mom, and I. So they were in three different sizes. And so I took one and I put my hand in it and just closed it like you would a mouth. And it just sort of naturally formed this furry puppet. And that was kind of the first character I created was out of this homemade house shoe.
What was that character named?
His name was Leon. Yeah.
And what was Leon like?
He was just I don't know what he was. He was just a furry guy. It's been so long ago, I don't even really remember.
So when did you know you were going to make a career out of being a puppeteer?
Probably when I was in the fifth grade. We had to do a history report, and the teacher sort of sectioned out the lessons. And the section that I got was on the gold rush. And I knew more than anything, I did not want to get in front of the class and do a report. I did not want to read a report or give a report. I didn't want to be, you know, I didn't want to get up and do anything. So I thought, well, I'll do puppets. So we turned a table over on its side, and I had these characters. And much in the same way I work today, like I didn't have a script. I sort of knew the historical aspects I had to get across, but the rest of it was improvised. And I didn't know what was going to happen, really. I just thought, well, it's sink or swim time. Here we go. And the class laughed. My teacher laughed. From where the table was, I could look over to my right and see my teacher, and she just sort of had her head on her desk, just cackling. Because it was improvised, it came back to bite me because she liked it so much she wanted me to do it for the class next door. I mean, it's one thing if you're a seasoned improviser, you know, you can sort of recreate or try your best. But so as a fifth grader, I had to sort of recreate. And this other poor class, they just sort of didn't get it. But anyway, that's when I was kind of hooked. I was like, wow, this is really powerful. Like there's something to this, and there's something I really, really connected with about just making an audience, making audience laugh, and just being behind the scenes and being able to do that.
So when did you start making your own puppet?
I was a middle schooler. I had some store-bought puppets, and I had some sort of higher-end professional-grade puppets, but I had these characters in my mind that I wanted to see created, and there just wasn't really any way to do that unless I figured it out for myself how to do that. So I went to Elsie Lipscomb, and we sort of dissected a puppet that I had and kind of figured out how to put one together.
And wait, did you really cut apart one of your puppets?
No, we sort of layered on top of it. So we like, you know, we'd take paper and make patterns based on the shape of the thing. So we didn't cut one apart. I don't think I could have stood that. But we came close. So yeah, and she sewed all my puppets for about a year until I figured out the mechanics of using a sewing machine, because that's how I did things. It wasn't until later I learned how to hand stitch, which was tedious and arduous.
Were you a middle schooler with a sewing machine?
Yeah. Well, I commandeered my mother's old Singer. Yeah, she had an old Singer from the 70s that was just collecting dust, and I took it. So, yeah, we'd go to the fabric store, and I'd buy all this crazy fur and all this kind of stuff and just sort of figured it out, you know, and I'd make all these puppets every weekend. I had no social life. Like, I was kind of a, I don't know, I wasn't one of the popular kids, I'll put it that way. So I didn't have a social calendar to worry about. So I was in my room usually making all these crazy puppets.
What did your peers think of your puppets?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I know what they think of it now because of the magic of Facebook. you know, when you're growing up, everybody's sort of into their, you know, sort of typical middle school, teenage kind of stuff, and puppets were not on that spectrum. They just weren't.
So do friends want to see your puppet shows? Do they make fun of you?
There were a few that didn't quite get it, and that's, you know, they would tease or whatever. And it's one of those weird things, like after I graduated college and came back home for a little while, you know, I had some guy come up to me who was, I think he was a class or two behind me, and he said, "Man, we thought you were so cool." And I'm like, I didn't think I was. I never got that vibe. I found the most support from my teachers, actually. I had a lot of teachers who saw some potential, you know, in this really creative kid who was doing something that was different and not, you know, the status quo, and was sort of following his own drummer. And I think that spoke to a lot of them. So I got a lot of support from my teachers.
What about your parents? Were they supportive, or were they like, you need to be a lawyer?
They were. My parents have always been super supportive of my endeavors. My father, maybe a little more so, because when I was a teenager, I got involved with an organization called the Puppeteers of America, and they're a national organization for puppeteers and puppet enthusiasts. Every year there are festivals, and every even year there's a regional festival for different regions of the country, and every odd year there is a national festival, which are sort of big deals where it's a week-long thing of seeing performances and taking workshops and just mingling with professionals and enthusiasts and just anybody who's interested in puppets. And so before I was able to travel to these on my own, my dad would go with me, and he would be my chaperone, as it were. And so we got to experience a lot of these shows together, and we'd talk about it. And then when I started doing performances and getting paid for it, my mother got on board.
Then you went on to study puppetry.
I did. I had sort of a hodgepodge of formal training and informal training. Like, so I was self-taught a little bit, and then I For a long time, I've had a mentor in Richmond, Virginia named Terry Snyder, who for a long time had a puppet company called Applause Unlimited. And he sort of gave me the ins and outs of what it's like to be a solo puppeteer.
How did you meet Terry?
I met Terry at a Puppeteers of America festival. And my parents and I initially saw him at the Center for Puppetry Arts here in Atlanta years ago. I guess in 92, we saw Terry do a show.
But you were living in Alabama. Yeah. Did y'all come to Atlanta to see shows?
Well, we came because they had the Muppets on display. Like, they had the Pigs in Space guys on their permanent collection. So I was dying to see Muppets in person, which was what it was all about for me. Just like being able to have the opportunity to see a Muppet up close was just crazy. So we went to the museum and they said, well, would you like to add a performance to your ticket? And then we thought, well, what else are we going to do? So we went and we saw the show, and Terry was doing his Velveteen Rabbit, his one-man show. And it was the first time I'd seen a one-man show done so well and so beautifully. It blew my mind, really, because it opened me up to a whole new way of thinking about doing puppet theater, because you could do stuff really simply and really effectively just as one person. You didn't have to have this sort of army of performers or whatever, because I always thought I was limited because of how much I could do as one person if I didn't have other people to help me. And then Terry sort of changed my whole thinking about that. It's like you really have limitless possibilities as a solo performer.
How old were you when you met him?
I was 14 when I saw the show. And then when I was 16 or 17, I saw Terry do another show at a festival, and I invited myself up to his studio. And he said, oh, sure, okay. So like 2 weeks later, I boarded a plane for Richmond. And,
by yourself?
Yeah, by myself. And he said, I was always amazed that your parents let you do that, because they didn't know me from anybody. I could have been an axe murderer. But again, you know, back to your earlier question about my parents, like they knew that there was a limit to how much they could help me, you know, as far as pursuing this. And they knew that Terry had a lot of information to impart to me. And so they knew that they were sort of at the end of what they were able to give me, except for the opportunity of going to learn from somebody else.
So how long did you stay with him?
I'd stay about a week or two. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Out of every summer, like I would go for about a week and stay with Terry, and just we'd make puppets, we'd build stuff, we'd just hang out. I mean, it was just great to be in the company of a professional puppeteer. And it's a relationship we still have to this day. So, yeah, he's an amazing man and an amazing friend.
So we need to take a break, but can you lead us into break with a song?
Yeah, absolutely. How about I'll do you, since we're right close to Christmas, I'll play you a Christmas song I wrote about Christmas at the Waffle House.
Awesome. I can't wait to hear it.
Mama ain't gonna cook this Christmas. She says she's gonna quit. Nobody wants to help her out, and she's getting sick of it. There'll be no stirring in the kitchen, not even from the old gray mouse, for we all gonna load up the minivan and have Christmas at the Waffle House. Yeah, it's waffles for Christmas. Who needs a honey-baked ham? Turkey's overrated, so I'm making different plans. Pack up all the presents and don't forget your spouse. It'll be a yellow Christmas. We're all going to the Waffle House. Well, it may not be tradition, but Mama's got her wishes. She ain't gonna do the cooking, and she ain't about to do the dishes. Well, it won't do you no good to try to change your mind, so you can hang your Christmas stocking under that glowing yellow sign. It's waffles for Christmas and hash browns on the side, scattered, smothered, diced, and covered in a slice of pecan pie. Well, it ain't no good complaining, just eat it while it's hot. It's the only place open on Christmas, so what choice have we got? Waffle House waitress, she ain't no old Saint Nick, but she keeps the coffee coming, and that somehow does the trick. You don't have to wear your Sunday best, just come right as you are, and let that Waffle House sign guide you like the Bethlehem Star. It's waffles for Christmas. Who needs a honey-baked ham? Turkey's overrated, so I'm making different plans. Pack up all the presents and don't forget your spouse. It'll be a yellow Christmas. We're all going to the Waffle House. Yeah, it'll be a yellow Christmas. We're all going to the Waffle House.
For a little bit of everything from all over the globe, tune in to Weekend Cornucopia every Saturday and Sunday here on WREK Atlanta.
Thanks for listening to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm your host, Amanda Plum. This week, I'm talking with David Stevens, puppeteer and singer-songwriter. We were talking earlier about how you got into puppets as a kid and even started making and performing with puppets when you were really young. So tell me a little bit about your formal training.
Well, I went and studied theater at Troy University, and I got my bachelor's degree there, which was more theater. They sort of let me do my own thing when it came to the puppet stuff. I was brought in on a scholarship to work with a children's theater that they have at the time, hoping to incorporate some of the puppet stuff that I did.
Did they have classes in puppetry?
No, they didn't. So any opportunities I sort of created for myself, and one of those involved going to the broadcast journalism department and approaching them about doing a pilot, which we did. And they showed for many years. I don't know if they still show it or not. But, yeah, we made this little half-hour TV show pilot. It's called the TSU Puppet Review. At the time, Troy was Troy State University. And now it's just Troy University. And it was my attempt at sort of doing a Muppet show kind of thing with that format. Yeah.
Well, who was the audience?
It was on the college network. And anytime they needed to fill half an hour in their log for the day, they just plug in that show.
But you only made one episode?
Yeah, and they kept showing it over and over and over again.
Why didn't you make more?
Because of school. Because I had credit hours I had to accomplish and other stuff. And plays, you know, because of, you know, I was a theater student. I did a lot of the plays and all that stuff. So the time was just demanding. And in hindsight, I wish I had done more. But, you know, we did the one. And it was a good learning experience.
And so after college, you went on to get your master's?
I did. I didn't take any time off. I went straight to University of Connecticut, which I'd heard about for years because they have one of the only puppetry programs that offers both undergraduate and graduate degrees in puppet arts. So it was where I had to go. I mean, my options were limited, as it were. So as a graduate student, I got to do nothing but 2 years of concentrated puppetry classes, which was awesome.
What did you learn?
We learned about different puppet styles, different puppet construction techniques, different puppet performance techniques. So, for instance, there'd be a whole semester on hand puppetry, learning about different hand puppet cultures from Europe and Asia and America. And so we'd have one of those for hand puppets and shadow puppets, marionettes or string puppets, rod puppets. So we sort of cover all the bases on the different styles and the history of those styles. And then the performances as well as learning how to make puppets in each of those styles.
Before going to school, did you have a favorite style of puppetry?
Oh, the Muppet style, absolutely. Technically, it's a form of hand puppet, but we call it moving mouth hand puppet. Because if you think a hand puppet or a glove puppet, it's also like traditional Punch and Judy, where you have a finger in the head and in the hands and your thumb in the other hand. So that's a glove puppet or a hand puppet. But for Muppet style, we call it a moving mouth hand puppet.
And that's what you do today. But did you ever think maybe you're going to be a shadow puppeteer or marionetteer?
No, I mean, I didn't know enough about those styles of puppets to launch into them, which is part of the reason I wanted to go to University of Connecticut, was to diversify a little bit and to learn about those styles and to try them on and see how I felt in those other styles. I always came back home to the Muppet style just because it's where I started and where I felt most comfortable. But, you know, equally intriguing are those other styles and the people who are really masters at them, because just as it takes a lot of skill to do the Muppet style of performance, is the same for any style of puppet.
And so while you were in school, you developed one of your first shows that you took on the road?
Yeah, it was called Billy Goat's Gruff and Other Stuff. Initially, it was called Tales for the Telling. Funny story about that. So it was sort of a vignette show. So there was Little Red Riding Hood. There was a version of Three Little Pigs. And there was another hand puppet segment. And this shadow sequence for an old folk song called The Devil and the Farmer's Wife. It's hundreds of years old, and the devil comes up and approaches this farmer and takes his wife back with him to, you know, where he's from. And she creates such havoc down there that the devil brings her back. So it's a really funny song, and there are a lot of funny verses. And I sang the song live and did the shadow puppets behind the screen. And so I incorporated this as sort of the opening piece of this puppet show that I started touring in South Alabama libraries. So I was in my first week of performances in Hoover, Alabama, and I did the show, I did the sequence, and the children's librarian came up to me after the show, and she said, "We need to talk." And I said, okay. And she said, you know that whole thing with the devil in it? I said, yeah. She said, you're going to have to take that out. I said, what? And she said, yeah. It was when, as soon as that devil popped up on the screen, three families got up and left. So,
because it was too scary or was it
offensive? Because it was the devil. It was the devil. And at the time, she told me Harry Potter had just come out. And this was during that time when they couldn't even have book discussions about Harry Potter because there was sort of bad juju about, you know, magic and all that stuff. So I took it out because it didn't have anything to do with the rest of the show. But the show was 10 minutes short. So instead of trying to stick to my guns and keep the piece in the show, I realized that I was going to have to change it up. I was going to have to put something else in its place. And so I put in a version of the Three Billy Goats Gruff. And when the Center for Puppetry Arts wanted to host the show, they were like, we can't sell Tales for the Telling. Nobody knows what that is. So we sat down and I said, well, why don't we just call it Billy Goats Gruff and Other Stuff? And they said, okay. So that's how the show got its title. And I still tour it today. Like, I just, I've got some shows of it next week. So it's one of my favorites. And it's won an award from UNAMA, which is an international organization for puppetry, which I'm really proud of.
After grad school, is that when you started your company?
Yeah, I started All Hands Productions officially when I got my degree. And I moved back to Alabama. I knew I didn't want to stay up north. It was one of those weird cultural things where you can't wait to get out of a place until you get out of it, and then you realize how much of the place is part of you. So you really realize how much of a southerner you are when you leave the South, which is exactly what happened to me. So I did that. I would sort of try and corner my market, and I moved back to, you know, my home state to try and start this company. And I just started getting more and more work in Atlanta, and it just made more sense because Alabama's great and has a lot going for it artistically, but, you know, at the time I was 24, and there wasn't much happening for a 24-year-old puppeteer in South Alabama. So I decided, okay, I'm going to try the city. So I moved to Atlanta in 2003, and I've been here ever since, on and off.
And so you actually moved to New York City for a while to try your hand as a TV puppeteer?
I did. I got an invitation to audition. At the time, Disney had just acquired the Muppet Show characters. So when you think of the work of Jim Henson, it's sort of split into three different companies now. Sesame Workshop, which used to be Children's Television Workshop, now owns the Sesame Street characters, Big Bird and Oscar and Grover and those. Jim Henson Productions owns things like Fraggle Rock and the fantasy work like Dark Crystal and Labyrinth and Emmett Otter. And Disney purchased the rights to the Muppet Show characters. So Kermit, Fozzie, Miss Piggy, Gonzo, Rolf, those guys. And Disney was trying to find some additional puppeteers for some of the main characters. Now, they didn't really go into what that was all about or what it was, but the Henson family encouraged me to audition for this. And so I did. And at the same time Muppets were looking for people, Sesame was also sort of looking at talent that was out there. And Sesame, a little later on, had what they call a cattle call or a training workshop. And it's a week-long thing, and they invite a bunch of people, and they sort of whittle them down as the week goes on. And so I was sort of there at the end of the week. And bear in mind, nobody was offering any jobs. They were looking at people and really wanting to see what was out there.
It's like a week-long audition.
Yeah, but without the idea that there'd be a job at the end of it. I mean, it was sort of like, we want to see who's out there, but we can't hire anybody. Really, when you think about it, Sesame Street used to produce 9 months of the year. Now they're in production 8 weeks of the year. They produce 26 episodes each season now. They produce one episode per letter of the alphabet. So they really don't have enough work for the mainstay performers that they've had for, you know, almost 50 years. I did the workshop, and my gut, like by the middle of the week, my gut was saying, you need to move to New York. And I was like, are you kidding? Like, they're not offering any jobs. Like, but there was also the part of me that knows you got to be where the work is if you want to get the work. And if there was any work to be had, I knew that that's where you had to be. And so, like, within a month, it's really ridiculous. I came back and I tried to talk to anybody who could talk me out of it, and they all had my bags packed. So I got rid of my apartment, I put everything in storage, and I moved to New York with two suitcases and my banjo and the hopes and dreams of a young puppeteer. It was crazy. I realized it was probably a good thing I didn't ask myself more questions about that adventure beforehand. I think if I had, I probably would have talked myself out of it, because I got there and I was like, I'm here. Now what? So my first job in New York was as a puppet wrangler for the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade on the Cartoon Network float. And they were doing Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends. So I was a puppet wrangler on that float. and it rained, and the float leaked, and we were all inside this float, this wooden, you know, claptrap structure, and we were drenched. But it was a lot of fun. I mean, despite all that, it was like to be in the Macy's parade was amazing.
How did you get that job?
Through a friend who was also a puppeteer. The puppetry really very supportive of each other, because if you get work for somebody, then chances are they're going to get work for you. So we each scratch each other's backs, and that's generally how it is in our world. So it was a few months after that that I got a call about working on a show called Seymour's Playhouse, which was a PBS show produced by Connecticut Public Broadcasting. They needed a puppeteer to take over one of their main characters, because a secondary character who was performed by the same person had sort of been elevated to main character status. So they needed somebody to take over his main character. So I auditioned and worked for 16 weeks as Shades the Wolf on Seymour's Playhouse, which was how I learned television puppetry. That was really on-the-job training. I was familiar with the technique of, you know, you can set up a video camera and hook it up to a television, and you play to the camera, because that's really the frame of the television is the frame of reference for the puppeteer. And the puppeteer in the TV world is really locked into watching that frame, because it's the only frame of reference you have for knowing where your puppet is in relationship to space, and knowing when your head's in the shot or when your arm's in the shot, when you're showing things you don't need to be showing. So while it seems like it should be just a very simple, you know, oh, just wiggle on a puppet, actually, everything's in reverse. So when you're doing everything for television, if you move in real space to the right on the television, you're moving to the left. So your brain has to get used to that. So we call that jello head a lot of the time, because you really have to sort of get used to that. And it has to become second nature. So that was really how I learned how to finesse those techniques of television puppetry, and watching the monitor and watching your performance and working with other people. I mean, that's also a big thing about dynamic.
Oh, right, because you had pretty much done your own shows up to this
point.
Exactly,
exactly. You know, if you think about, you know, if you see, you know, four or five puppets on a TV screen, there's usually about that number, if not double that number, underneath them. There's this army of people below the frame that you never see, all the stuff that's what's happening on your screen. And there's a real choreography to that, and there's a real performer dynamic that goes into all those performances.
So we need to take a break, but before we do that, did you bring any other songs for us?
I will play you a song about a great Atlanta institution located on Ponce de Leon Avenue. It's my favorite place to go late at night. It's 2 in the morning, you're nowhere around. I find myself driving downtown. There's only one surefire thing gonna help me wake up from this bad, bad dream. I'll drive down Ponce de Leon Avenue and go into that Krispy Kreme. Well, rest assured, there's hope in sight, and I see that bright flashing neon light telling me there's hot donuts now. There's a sugar line into my darkest cloud. I'll drive down Ponce de Leon Avenue and go into that Krispy Kreme. Well, there's a hole in the middle and it's glazed all around. A bit of painkiller has yet to be found. So baby, if you decide to leave this town, I know where to go. I'll get me a dozen variety pack, a big old cup of coffee and one of them silly paper hats. It's hard to feel blue when you're looking like that. And I don't care if you never come back. I'll drive down Ponce de Leon Avenue and go into that Krispy Kreme. Well, there's a hole in the middle and it's glazed all around. A bit of paint killer has yet to be found. So baby, if you decide to leave this town, I know where to go when them blues come around. I'll get me a dozen variety pack, a big old cup of coffee and one of them silly paper hats. It's hard to feel blue when you're looking like that. And I don't care if you never come back.
Whiteshead, Lehon Avenue, and going to that Krispy Kreme. I love you, Krispy Kreme.
You're listening to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta. You're listening to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm your host, Amanda Plum, and today I'm talking with puppeteer and banjoist. Is that a word?
That is a word, yes.
Puppeteer and banjoist, David Stevens. After Seymour's Playhouse.
Oh, I got the call you always wait for. You got a call from a producer at Sesame Street who says, we'd like to give you a season contract. And we're like, what? It was pretty great. I worked two episodes on season 39 of Sesame Street. First project I worked on was Abby in Wonderland, which was a takeoff on Alice in Wonderland with Abby Kadabi, their female character.
So this was like for home video?
Yeah, direct to home video. And then they called me about doing the season. So that was my sort of tryout, was with Abby. And then I did the season, and my first day I was in what they call an anything Muppet. And an anything Muppet is basically a blank puppet that they can put any number of facial features on, and they can change them, and they can...
It's like, you know, a Mr. Potato Head. They
exactly.
can put different eyes and nose and
That's right.
mouth. And...
That's exactly the idea. So instead of having to build new puppets all the time, they can just change the features of these blank puppets.
Is that like Velcro?
Yeah, Velcro and pins and double-faced tape and a lot of that stuff. So I was an anything Muppet my first episode. Yeah, I'll never forget it because it was a real obstacle course. You don't want to be the new guy who blows the take. I mean, nobody wants to be that guy. You're the newbie. You're the green guy on set. The first episode, my puppet had to do a limbo. There were pogo sticks. There were all these kinds of puppet props and movement that we were on the street. Now, sometimes in puppetry, film, and television, if it's strictly just puppets, for the ease of the puppeteers, they'll build all the sets up so that you can stand and perform. But when you're working on Sesame Street, on the street itself, it's a set made for human actors. So all the puppeteers are on these little rolling carts that are about 3 inches off the ground. So there's a maze of television monitors on the floor of the studio with cables running out of them. All the puppeteers are rolling around on these 3-inch rolling carts. There were kids on set, and so it was a real obstacle course. Fortunately, the fates of the Muppeteers gone on before were with me, and I got through the episode fine. It was great. And they tape at the Kaufman Astoria Studios in Astoria, and you walk on the set, and you're instantly 5 years old again because, you know, there's the stoop, there's Big Bird's Nest, there's Oscar's trash can, there's Hooper's store. I mean, it's all there.
And some of the actors were the same actors we watched as kids.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Bob and Maria. Unfortunately, you know, I got to know some of the Muppeteers, that generation of performers, shortly before they passed. I got to be good friends with Jerry Nelson, who was the Count, among others. He was the Mel Blanc of the Muppet world. He was the voice, they called him. And he just did a whole myriad of characters in the course of his career. He and I got to be good buddies through music, actually. A lot of people didn't know he was a songwriter, besides being a brilliant Muppet performer. So we sort of bonded over that and became good friends over that. And I also was good friends with Jane Henson, Jim's widow, and she and I got to be really good friends.
What did it mean for you to end up on Sesame Street after, you know, idolizing it since you were a little kid?
It was the culmination of a childhood dream. I mean, yeah, it's really hard to explain because when you're in the thick of that moment, I guess the best way for me to explain it is when I went on the set and I put on one of the Muppet puppets and I was, you know, in that scenario, I felt like that's what I'd been training my whole life for. I didn't feel like a duck out of water. I didn't feel like I was doing something that was beyond my capacity. I felt like everything I had done up to that point was leading me to being on that set, being on that show, and performing those characters.
Why'd you come back to Atlanta?
There are no guarantees. Television sort of proves that. And Seymour's, I should say, had wrapped. Seymour's wasn't going to come back for another season, so I wasn't guaranteed of that work. And with Sesame, I'd worked two episodes, and I wasn't really guaranteed more work. I didn't know if I would get more work or if I'd have less work or the same amount of work, but it's very expensive to live in New York. I loved the work experiences. I loved being around so many of my friends who were puppeteers in New York, but I didn't necessarily like the city that much. So, yeah, there was definitely a part of me that yearned to be back south and to be back in Atlanta. So I moved back here in 2008.
So you moved back to the ATL. What have you been doing since you moved back?
Well, I worked on something called Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, the musical.
What is that?
So Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas started as a children's book by Russell and Lillian Hoban, who also created the Francis franchise. And Emmett Otter was a sort of retelling of the Gift of the Magi with woodland creatures. Jim took that and
Jim Henson.
Jim Henson.
We're not all on a first name basis with him like you are.
So he took that and in 1979 produced a television special called Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, keeping very dedicated to the original text. And so years and years and years later, Christopher Catelli, who's a Broadway choreographer and director, and Paul Williams, who's a Grammy-winning songwriter who wrote Rainbow Connection, among other hits, they approached the Henson Company about producing a musical, a live stage musical version of Emmett Otter. And so I was cast as a puppeteer the first year, and the second year we did it, I was also an actor. It was produced at the Goodspeed Opera House, which a lot of shows that start at the Goodspeed in East Haddam, Connecticut, get propelled onto Broadway. So I think that was the initial hope for the show. We ran it 2 years, and it was a really great, great experience getting to work with Paul Williams directly and again with the Henson Company and with a lot of like first-rate Broadway performers. That was a whole different experience for me. It was great. So besides that, I've also been doing my company work, so touring all over the place, into Canada, all up and down the Eastern Seaboard, and some to the Midwest. So, yeah, just doing my original shows and producing original shows, too.
And you have a friend with you today?
I do. I did bring Norbert.
Can you describe Norbert before we meet him?
Oh, you want me to describe myself?
Ah, hi, Norbert.
Yes, hello. I am, I'm rather comparatively short. I'll put it that way. Comparatively short. I am fuzzy. I am purple. I have two very large, pretty eyes. I guess I'm a monster for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, do you identify as a monster?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, yeah.
Do you find that like as a derogatory term or?
No. Do you find human derogatory?
I don't. But
okay.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. It's just my species.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's really nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you. It's nice to be in this fancy schmancy radio station.
Yeah.
Wow.
Have you been on the radio before?
I have not.
Yeah.
I have not been. I've been on television, but not on the radio.
Yeah, I'm assuming puppets don't find themselves on the radio very often.
No.
And just for people that are listening, I want you to know that I am actually interviewing Norbert now. He is here. He's sitting on David's
yes,
lap.
Yes, I'm not a figment of your imagination.
That's a nice hat you're wearing.
Thank you. It's seasonal, you know, the old Santa hat.
Yeah? Are you doing any shows this season? Or?
Yes, we're doing Santa's Missing Mail. You tell me about that. Okay. So Santa's Missing Mail is actually one of the oldest shows in my repertoire. I think I made it when I was still in high school. And I still tour it every Christmas. So I'll be doing that show at the Aurora Playhouse and some other places though this season. But it's an annual favorite. So Norbert is actually, that's the only show that Norbert is actually in.
Well, Norbert,
yeah.
What do you do when you're not performing?
Oh, I hang out in the duffel bag. Yeah.
Is it cozy?
A few touches here and there, and it's homey, yeah.
But you've done other things. I've seen you at festivals before.
Yes, I do a lot of what he calls walk-arounds. That's where I interact with the public. Yeah, talk to people, tell them about what he does.
How do people react to you? Because it's not every day that people see a purple monster.
It is true. I find that I get one of two reactions, either aggression or affection.
People are aggressive towards you?
Oh, yeah. They either want to hug me or hit me. Yeah.
Which do you prefer?
I like the hugs. I do like the... I'm not against tough love, but I will take the hugs any day.
Now, speaking of aggressive behavior,
yes.
I heard of something really traumatic that happened to you recently.
Oh, my, this is horrible.
I heard about this on Facebook.
I was stolen. Mm. I was abducted. I think we can both talk about this, but...
Yeah, it sounds like Norbert's getting a little emotional about this.
It's traumatizing. So I was playing this banjo gig, and while I was doing the gig, my car was broken into. Well, I called my now wife. I said, do you remember what I took with me from the puppet event today? And she said, well, you had the box of brochures. Now, yeah, they're here. And she said, you had this other thing? I said, yeah, that's here. She said, and you had Norbert. And I looked, and I said, they took Norbert.
And it was just one of those, like, heart sink to your toes kind of moments of just like, oh, no, they took of all the things. That, and I still had, like, a bunch of equipment in the back of my van, and all they took was the duffel bag, which Norbert was inside, that was sitting on the passenger seat. I didn't know what to do, so I come home, and I made up these little flyers with Norbert's picture on it saying, you know, stolen.
He did a good job, you know, considering. He did very good, you know. I mean, it's not like you gotta wait 24 hours to report, you know, as a missing monster.
Well, that was the other funny thing. Like, so we did have an officer. You know, I called it in, and we had an officer, and I kept thinking, how am I going to explain to this guy what I had stolen? I mean, it's one thing to say I had CDs stolen, or I had a pair of shoes, or, you know, but a puppet. How am I going to tell this guy I got a puppet stolen out of my car? He's not going to take me seriously. But he was actually very nice about it, and he said, "Well, was it, you know, like a string puppet, or was it like a Jeff Dunham?" And I said, "Well, it's like a Muppet." So he was actually very helpful and very concerned about it. So he was
probably
a nice
one of the more
guy.
Interesting reports he had to write up that day.
Exactly.
So how did you get him back?
The next day, a friend of mine and I sort of spread out and looked all over Kirkwood, and about 20 feet away from the car, there was this sort of tree line that separated this parking lot from a residence, and they had just thrown Norbert into that tree line.
So I sat out all night exposed to the elements. Yeah, mm. There were bugs.
Oh, wow. Have you sought therapy or anything about this?
I'm dealing with it in my own way. Yeah,
what's
chocolate.
That? Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Lots of chocolate. Mm-hmm.
Great.
Yeah.
How long have you guys been together?
Let's see. This is the third incarnation of Norbert. The first one I created, I think, in 2003. The first Norbert was just one of four monsters I made just for fun. And when I needed to have a puppet character to just sort of interact that wasn't a part of a show, the puppet I gravitated toward was this, who didn't even have a name at that point. That puppet wore out, basically, because, you know, these puppets are made out of foam rubber on the inside, and so after a long time of use, your hand sweats, and there's oils and all this stuff, and so the foam just breaks down.
Norbert, it's disgusting, isn't it?
Yeah, he sweats in your head?
I know. It's gross. Let me tell you, you don't want a sweaty hand. Never mind. Never mind. Just keep talking.
So eventually I had to rebuild Norbert, and so I built the second version of him. I gave him legs. He's one of the few puppets of mine that actually has legs. And then that puppet, we did a video with Kelly McFarling, who's a great singer-songwriter from here originally but lives out in San Francisco. With that second Norbert, we shot the video, and I realized that the fur that I'd used on that second puppet was really absorbing light instead of reflecting it. Norbert just became this sort of dark blotch on frame. And so I knew that I wanted to rebuild a puppet with that in mind. And so this is how the third puppet came. It was really interesting, too, you know, when the puppet was abducted or stolen or whatever, there were people who just said, oh, well, it's fine, you got the pattern, just make another one. But I don't know, there was something really jarring about that prospect because, you know, in my mind, I could make another puppet that looks just like Norbert, but
he'd be an imposter. It would not be the same. No. It would be like my evil twin,
because I would know that, you know, Norbert, quote unquote, would be out there somewhere, and who knows where. I mean, that was the thing, you know, you sort of, you know, you go through your head, well, did they try and sell it on eBay, or did they just give it to their kid? You know, there were all these scenarios I was running in my head about what the fate of this puppet would be, and if, you know, I'd ever see it again. I don't know. It sounds pretty kooky. You know, it's like, I don't know. And I was never one to sort of think of myself as precious about these things. You know, I make them, I perform with them. There is a connection that happens in that. But this was the first time I was really faced with, like, the what that connection really is and what that's all about and how strong it is. And, you know, if it's more than just a connection with a tool or you're not going to like this, Norbert, but he's not a person to me. He's an entity to me. You know, he's a character to me. And the puppet itself, you know, the physical puppet is definitely connected to all that.
Whatever. Be quiet. Stop talking. Ask me a question.
I was actually just going to thank you for coming out.
Oh, is that it? You're done with me?
Well, I wanted to talk about...
I'll get to sing.
Do you sing?
All the peanut butter sandwiches. That's my tribute to the amazing Mumford. Okay. Am I done? You're done. Okay. Happy holidays to you, Miss Amanda.
It was great seeing you
thank
again.
Thank you for... I'm going to shake your hand. Thank you for having me on your radio show.
Yeah, thank you for
coming. Maybe you should
coming.
Post a picture of me so that people can see me Do you have a website in conjunction with this show?
We do. I think it would be a good idea to post a photo.
Yeah. So they can look at me while the show is playing.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you really deserve a visual medium.
Thank you. I agree. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming down.
Of course.
Thanks for tuning into the North Avenue Lounge. I'm your host, Amanda Plum. And today I'm here with David Stevens, a puppeteer. And he's also a singer-songwriter.
Yes.
I think we should talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
So, as a child, you had a few attempts at music.
Oh, Lordy. I guess like every child goes through this where the parent wants them to learn an instrument. So I survived two lessons with piano as a seven-year-old. And the tedium of having to like play hot cross buns for half an hour was more than my little mind could take. It was just like, no, I'm not doing this. So, yeah, that was the end of that. Later on, I was not a terribly physically active child. Like, PE did not appeal to me in any way.
You weren't, like, on the football team?
No, absolutely not.
Running track?
Nothing. I did anything and everything I could to avoid it, including joining the band. So I played the trombone from my fifth grade year up through my eighth grade year, purely as a means to get out of PE. I had really no interest in band or learning to play music necessarily in that way.
So why didn't you stick with the band?
Because it proved to be equally as humiliating an experience as PE.
Why?
In eighth grade, we were allowed to be in the marching band, and I could not march and play at the same time, and my band director took my mouthpiece away. So I was literally a warm body out on the field with my trombone, walking around in the formations, you know, just sort of miming the fact that I was not playing. Yes. And it wasn't until much, much, much later when I was in college that I just started listening to folk music. And most people have their parents' record collections that are full of like the random Peter, Paul, and Mary album or that kind of stuff, but not mine. I had to go out and find all those records. So there was some little bug about like the 60s folk stuff when I started getting all these records and listening to all this stuff. And then I found out that there was a coffee house not too far from where I was that did live music every weekend. And so they would get guys from Texas or Nashville. We had Sean Mullins from Atlanta that used to play there before he hit it big. I approached the owner and I said, so do you take any other acts besides musicians? And I was a senior in high school at the time. And he said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, I'm a puppeteer. And he said, oh, that's great. You could do sets in between the musician sets. So I did. I'd do like a 15-minute routine between the musicians. And some of the musicians actually wanted to incorporate the puppets in their show. So like with Sean, puppets would sing with Sean. But through that, I also met a guy named Mike West, who at the time was living in New Orleans. And he was a banjo player and a singer-songwriter. And I had a guitar that I got because everybody gets one. I think that's like a rite of passage. When you go to college, you get a guitar. I think the first song I learned was Bob Dylan's Times They Are Changin'. That was the first song I learned on guitar. But Mike really sort of set the wheels in motion in my head that I could write songs. And so I had a banjo because I listened to way too much Pete Seeger. You know, I really didn't get into it until Mike, and listening to Mike and actually watching a banjo player do what he did really inspired me to really be serious about being a banjo player. All that sort of like took off when I was in college.
And tell me about Will Robertson.
Will is an amazing classically trained bass player from the Berklee School of Music. He and I met right before I moved to Atlanta. And there was a group of songwriters who would meet at Java Monkey in Decatur every Monday night. And I'd been to a couple of open mic kind of things, and I was really sort of skeptical about them. And so I had the banjo in the car, and I wanted to check this group out first to see what they were all about. I liked what I was hearing, and so I said, hey, you guys mind? I got my banjo in the car. And they were like, go get it. So, and Will was in that group, and so I played a couple of songs for them, and Will and I played together. And like a couple of weeks later, we had our first gig, and that was sort of the birth of Banjolicious. As we call ourselves. So, yeah, Will actually produced the last two records I made. So he's been a great friend and a great musician.
So what is Banjolicious?
Banjolicious is me and whoever else plays with me. So sometimes it's just me, and sometimes it's me and either Will or Rob Henson, who's an equally amazing bass player. Sometimes it's Ian Blanton and John Michelson. We play together at Big Tech's in Decatur, usually once a month for their bluegrass brunch on Sundays. It's an all-encompassing name for my banjo act.
And so you've put out six albums?
I have. I started making records in 2001 after I got out of grad school. And it was really at Mike West's encouragement because I would write these songs and I'd send Mike demos of stuff I was working on. And he's like, man, this stuff's great. Let's come down and make a record. So I would go down to New Orleans and I'd made four of my records with him. And
Yeah, it was just a really amazing time to go down to the studio and have all these New Orleans musicians come in and play on my tracks. And it was a real collaborative effort in a different way for me.
Do each of your albums have a different feel or theme to them?
Absolutely. Like the first record was definitely more about my experience as a grad student at UConn. The second record is all about family because it happened right around the time that my grandmother passed away.
Is that family album?
Yeah, family album. And then Far Cry, I made sort of around the same time. It just didn't have anything to do with family. And it was sort of this cornucopia of themes. You know, there's a song on Far Cry about biscuits and gravy. And that was a really, really fertile songwriting time for me. Like, I was writing all the time. And then the one after that was Postcards from Sadness. And there's songs about New York, as there are in A Year and Some Change. A Year and Some Change is really about coming home and, like, being homesick and a lot of that stuff.
Can we hear a song from A Year and Change?
Yeah, what do you want to hear?
Let's just hear Before You Break My Heart.
Okay, that's the sad one.
Before you break my heart, love me till the sun comes up, until it hurts me just enough. You can disappear, don't try to tell my heart why it is you have to go. It really doesn't care to know. Answers just bring tears, 'cause you were born to run. So baby, run as fast as you can go. Just can't keep up, so baby, run as fast as you can go. Before you break my heart, I'll watch you putting on your clothes, then turn slowly to the door. Never looking back, that's when I know my heart won't be like it was before. Tears will flow and blood will pour from scars you leave behind. Born to run, so baby, run as fast as you can go. I just can't keep up, so baby, run as fast as you can go. We'll find a way to move along. I'll write a few more lonesome songs and start all over again. 'Cause me and this old heart, we've seen our share of ups and downs, always managed to land on the ground. So don't worry about me. Just can't keep up, so baby, run as fast as you can go before you break my heart. Love me till the sun comes up, until it hurts me just enough. You can disappear.
So that was Before You Break My Heart by David Stevens, and he's in the studio with me today. So I was doing research on you, and I don't know if you know this, but you come up on the MTV.com artist page.
What?
You have an artist page, and it has four of your albums. But then when you click on the bio part, it says you're a footballer who plays for Barnett as a defender. And there's like this whole paragraph about you as a footballer. I think the website must have some sort of coding where they just like pull a bio someone else with that name. So it's clearly your music, but you're a footballer.
I'm a football player.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
The other thing I noticed on your website is that in addition to the 6 albums you've put out, mm-hmm. you've played on another 20-odd albums.
Yeah, which is it's totally fun to play on other people's stuff, and it's a way to sort of exercise your musical muscles in a different way. I find that totally fun to like. Usually, you know, I won't have necessarily heard the song I'm playing on until I go in the studio, and you just sort of figure something out, and it's really creative in a different way.
So A Year and Change was your most recent album.
Yeah.
And it came out when?
Oh, Lordy. When did it come out? 2010, I think, something like that.
So it sounds like you're overdue for another album.
If I could write songs, I mean, that's the thing. It's like I haven't written much of anything. I think the Waffle House song is something I've written in the time between, but I just haven't written a whole lot. I don't know why that is. The muse, she is funny. Yeah, it seemed like when I was writing the most, I had a lot to be sad about, or I felt like there was a lot of sad, and that's how I cope with things. In fact, like when I go to shows and promote the albums, I'm like, you know, you could buy the whole set of records, my mini series, or what I call coping with my 20s.
And now you're just too happy to write music.
Exactly.
Well, I do have one final question for
sure.
You. This is a question I ask all my guests, and it comes from my brother-in-law Kevin Hernandez. He believes there's two types of people in this world.
Oh.
Skee-ball people and whack-a-mole people. Which are you and why?
Oh, definitely whack-a-mole. Absolutely. Oh, man, it's like those little puppet heads coming up out of the thing, and you just get to whack them. I guess that goes back to the Marvin Suggs, the Muppet who had the Muppaphones. But yeah, these little heads just come up and you whack it.
Awesome. I like how decisive you are. If people want to hear more about your music or your puppetry, where is that available?
I have a website at allhandsproductions.com, and that also links up to my music site, which is David Stevens Banjo, and Stevens with a PH. And All Hands Productions will sort of take you through the rabbit hole of David Stevens things. I've got an Etsy store. On the banjo site, you can direct download tracks. There's a whole plethora of things you can do in the world of David Stevens.
And you mentioned your Etsy store. You make plush animals, hand puppets.
Yeah, we keep expanding. The zoo keeps growing.
I've seen them. They're really cute. You have frogs and
frogs
bunnies
and rabbits and monsters and alligators and monkeys and
Glarfs,
which are a brand new scarf glove puppet combination. I'm pretty excited about those. So
where do you make all these?
My wife and I live on North Avenue, and we have a studio in the house where all this stuff gets made.
So we have a whole room that's nothing but, you know, fabric and eyeballs and all that. I mean, not real eyeballs, but, you know, plastic bits and things that we use for puppet parts.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming out and talking to me today.
Sure. Thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
Thanks. And thank you guys for listening to the North Avenue Lounge. We're here every Monday at noon. You can find this and past episodes on our website, www.northavenuelounge.com. You'll also find a photo of Norbert on our website. And we're now on iTunes. So this and other episodes are available for download on iTunes. Thank you.